Welcome to the REWORK Primary View, where we cover the latest developments in high yield, distressed debt, and bankruptcy, and feature discussions on issues affecting distressed debt, leveraged finance, direct lending, high yield bonds, high yield municipals, covenants, private credit, and middle market companies. I'm David Zupkis. This week, Seth Brumby, Deputy Managing Editor at REWORK, talks to Greg Hardiman, a Managing Director of 17 Capital, about the growth and use cases for net asset value, or NAV, lending. Seth and Greg discuss the evolution of NAV lending, its relationship to other forms of fund financing, and how it can improve overall private equity realizations. And as always, we bring you our weekly summary of interesting developments in the restructuring world, as well as a preview of what's on tap for next week. It's Tuesday, March 12th.
Hello, everyone. And welcome to today's edition of REWORK Primary View, REWORK's podcast on all things fixed income. I'm Seth Brumby, Deputy Managing Editor at REWORK. Joining me today is Greg Hardiman, a Managing Director at 17 Capital. Greg, thanks you for joining us. You're here today on a really specific and interesting topic, NAV lending. And I was wondering, actually, if you can get us started with just talking a little bit about what NAV lending is and what it stands for.
Sure. Seth, thanks so much for having us on. Really great to be here with you all and joining your audience. And happy to start the conversation with some of the ABCs on NAV finance, so to speak. So how we would describe NAV finance, it is lending against the consolidated equity value of a portfolio of assets, or the net asset value of that portfolio, which is where the terminology comes from. The main difference between traditional lending or traditional private credit is that traditional private credit is lending to a particular company or asset, right? Whereas NAV finance is across a portfolio. And that could be a portfolio held within a fund. It could be a portfolio held by a specific investor.
Okay. If you could actually just bring us through a little bit of the history of NAV lending. I understand it's been around for probably 10 to 15 years, but if you could describe the evolution for us, that'd be great.
Sure. So our firm, 17 Capital, we've been around since 2008. So we have a 16-year track record in the NAV finance space. And our focus within NAV finance is really specific to traditional private equity. So private equity buyout, LBOs, in terms of the underlying exposure we're lending to. And the reason why I highlight that is because NAV finance, it's used broadly across the alternative asset ecosystem, right? So NAV finance is used for private credit portfolios, to some extent for real asset portfolios as well. So much of our commentary here will be focused in and around private equity, which is our day-to-day point of focus. And going back to the very beginning, 2008, we really consider ourselves the pioneers of NAV finance for private equity. This was long before there was specific terminology associated with the space. And really, our founders at 17 Capital, even predating 2008, I think 2007, 2006, they had come out of the secondary private equity market. And really, the light bulb that went off in their heads, the genesis of 17 Capital, was thinking about the perspective of a limited partner, an investor in private equity, and the range of options they have at their disposal to seek liquidity or seek financing, which at the time was very, very limited, right? Really limited to the secondary private equity market, right? So selling as the primary option to access liquidity to invest back into the portfolio. And so that's why 17 Capital was created, to be able to provide flexible capital to enable investors in private equity to maintain their exposure, hold their upside, but have liquidity to then reinvest further. And as you can imagine, back in 2008, 2009, 2010, the early days of our firm, there very much was a need for liquidity within the private equity ecosystem, and specifically with limited partners. So that's where it started. The market has since evolved to encompass really the entire ecosystem of private equity, right? So NAV finance today is applied to private equity funds, right? And when you hear the term NAV loans being referenced in the broader media, That's typically what that's referring to, right? A private equity fund taking on financing across the portfolio. Mm-hmm. But the market is also very active with the private equity firms themselves, right? So the management companies of private equity and their partners who require growth capital on an ongoing basis to continue to invest alongside their limited partners. And again, the limited partners themselves, right? So when we describe NAV finance, that is really the spectrum in the ecosystem we speak about today. It has existed now 16 years in some form, but it's really only since 2019, 2020 that the market has become institutionalized, mainstream, and now being referenced across the industry by multiple stakeholders.
Okay. Yeah, it strikes me that 17 Capital is more of a non-bank financial company. Can you maybe discuss some of the flexibility that a non-bank financial company has over more traditional fund financing that a bank provides?
Sure. You're exactly right. 17 Capital, we are organized as a fund manager ourselves, right? So we're a private credit specialist. We're operating exclusively in the NAV finance space. And we raise closed-end funds, much like any other private credit manager, with the difference being that our investments are always supported by an underlying portfolio. Now, we have the distinct advantage of being able to offer flexibility in terms of the structure that we're using, right? And in the early days, many of the investments we were completing were structured as preferred equity. Right. And we can go into further detail on what exactly preferred equity means in this context, because I think it can feel somewhat like a misnomer versus the preferred equity you're accustomed to seeing for an individual company. But that would be on the more flexible end. Right. So structures which don't have a maturity date, which really have a senior position in a cash flow waterfall. That's the way to think about them. And then you move along the spectrum and we can offer secured loans where you have proper security over underlying assets, maturity dates, maintenance covenants, many of the features you would expect to see in a corporate debt instrument, and then really anything in between, right? So having flexibility of mandate in our capital base and not needing to manage against regulatory constraints or guidance or risk-based capital ratios, that has enabled us to develop solutions that are the right fit for our counterparties, right? Primarily private equity sponsors, preserving their ability to manage their funds for the best interests of their limited partners, but also providing the right risk return profile for our limited partners in our capital base.
Okay. Can you describe a little bit about how you interact with other types of fund financing, specifically subscription financing? I understand that's pretty much early in the life of a fund, and you guys might come in later in the fund, but if you could talk a little bit about that dynamic.
Sure. So, and I think for the benefit of the audience, so for the purpose of this part of the discussion, we will be speaking about fund level NAV financing,
sure.
Right? And if you think about the life cycle of a private equity fund, you're exactly right, Seth. During the early years of the fund's life, the manager is going out, identifying and acquiring platform investments, right? New companies to go into the fund. During those early years, nearly every private equity fund will have some form of subscription line of credit, right, to smooth the capital call drawdown profile from the investors, right? And those facilities are ultimately backed by the creditworthiness of the LPs, right? They're supported by uncalled LP commitments. And so at the beginning of the life of the fund, obviously, that's when you have the largest amount of uncalled LP commitments, so the largest borrowing base for a subscription facility. Now, when you get to years really 3, 4, and 5, right, towards the end of the investment period of the fund has been largely or fully deployed, right? It has acquired all of the platform investments that it will plan to. The majority of the LP capital has been drawn, right? And as a result, that subscription facility is less relevant, right? It has a much smaller borrowing base. At that point in the fund's life, the manager is looking across their portfolio. They are prioritizing where they want to lean in and pursue follow-on investments, add-on M&A. Where are really the winners in the portfolio that they would like to continue to back with more capital, right? That is when the discussion around a NAV loan really comes into play, right? And the primary use case for a NAV loan at a private equity fund is exactly that. It's to complete follow-on investments, principally add-on acquisitions that tend to be the most accretive investments a private equity fund can make, right? And the alternatives that the manager is considering outside of an NAV loan would be additional financing at a particular portfolio company, right? Whether that's through additional senior debt, whether it's through some form of junior capital, think holdco pick. And the third alternative being putting more equity into the businesses, right? But again, we're at a point in the fund's life where most or all of the LP capital has been called. So that equity option typically is in the form of co-investment outside of the fund, in terms of the decision tree the manager's thinking about.
Okay. And with regard to that decision tree, you know, clearly when you have companies within a portfolio, they have their own borrowing capacity too. Maybe they can go out to the bond market, you know, tap their other options. Why would a portfolio manager choose to go with NAV lending as opposed to corporate level financing at that stage in the fund's life?
Sure. There's a few considerations, right? So there is an element around efficiency of putting a facility in place, right? Unlike a single company lender, we're lending against a diversified portfolio, mm-hmm. and we're assessing the portfolio as a whole, each individual asset as well, but ultimately the portfolio as a whole. That's where our credit comes from. It can be more quick to put in place a NAV loan versus taking on, as an example, a piece of junior capital at a particular asset, which is a very different risk attachment point in our view, okay. right? You also have the benefit as a manager of one, now having a new borrowing base, right? So should there be, and there usually are, opportunities across multiple assets in the fund, you can utilize one facility to address the needs and growth opportunities of multiple portfolio companies, right? Rather than needing to go execute separate financings, right? Okay. And then third would be the element around maintaining the optimal level of operating flexibility for a particular portfolio company, okay. right? NAV facilities, from our perspective, often or always have an element around cash versus PIC flexibility. Mm-hmm. Right? NAV facilities are repaid as and when there are distributions across the portfolio. Could okay. be from full exit, could be a dividend or a partial exit. But it does not create an ongoing cash burden on a particular asset in the same way that a traditional single company financing will.
Okay. Yeah. And you brought us to the, I guess, the final stage of life cycle for a fund, which is realization. And, you know, NAV lending sounds like it would be senior to the distributions that would be given to LPs and as a result of a, you know, a portfolio company being sold. Can you discuss a little bit about where NAV lending falls within that waterfall distributions to LPs and subscription facility pay downs?
Sure. So I think a few points of context. So a typical NAV loan at a fund is being put in place at a loan to value against the equity value of the fund of typically somewhere between 10 and 20%, right? So a relatively modest piece of the overall capital structure of the fund. Okay. And managers are very focused on ensuring they're striking the right balance in terms of the overall risk profile of their portfolio, underlying investments, and then ultimately the risk profile to their limited partners, right? And the ultimate goal of putting in place a NAV facility is to create accretive returns for the LPs and be able to take advantage of growth opportunities in the portfolio that the manager would otherwise not be able to take advantage of.
Sure.
Right? So that's point one. And as part of these facilities being put in place, the limited partners have a seat at the table, right? The manager is looking at their portfolio, they're thinking through their capital plan, and they're discussing their alternatives with their largest investors, right? And ensuring that there is broad-based comfort around utilizing a NAV loan at that stage in the fund's life.
Okay.
Right. And I think that's a really important point for many of your audience members, your listeners, who are allocators, right, and who may be seeing NAV loans being put in place at the private equity funds that they've backed.
Yeah, and I think the question at this point in the life cycle too would be, you know, the portfolio begins to sell companies, they're able to transact in the market and realize some gains. Does all of those gains get swept up first to the NAV lender and then later distribution go to LPs, or is there maybe more kind of a, I want to call it a pro rata share, that might not be the right terms, but you get that, there might be more of a share and equitable distribution of those proceeds.
Yeah, it's an excellent point. And it is one advantage of being a non-bank financing provider in that our goal for our funds and our investors is to create some duration on the capital, on the loans that we're putting in place, right? And the approach we're taking with the NAV loans, again, because we're entering at a fairly modest attachment point relative to the value of the portfolio, is that the repayment mechanics are guided by ongoing LTV of the loan against the portfolio, ongoing diversification, and time to maturity on the loan. The outcome of that is that the early distributions from the fund, once the NAV loan is put in place, will tend to flow to the LPs, right, before the NAV loan gets swept down.
Interesting. Okay. And I guess, you know, in the current environment that we're in, everybody is anticipating, everybody, when I say this, I mean people in the finance markets are anticipating a period where private equity funds can finally exit a lot of the transactions they got involved with, particularly prior to the pandemic too. Now we might go into a cycle of realization. But are we there yet? I mean, what kind of environment are we in right now, and how does NAV lending play its role within it?
Yeah. What I would say is that irrespective of market environment, the shift in private equity towards buy and build oriented strategies with a heavy add-on M&A component, that is a long-term secular trend, right? And if you look at a breakout of private equity-backed M&A, the share of add-on activity, certainly as a number of transactions, has continued to rise over the years, irrespective of the exit environment or liquidity environment for private equity.
Okay.
Right? That dynamic is very supportive of managers utilizing NAV loans and recognizing that NAV loans are a valuable portfolio management tool for their funds to enable them to best pursue their strategy. Okay. Right. So it's not necessarily guided by the exit environment at any point in time. Okay. Right. Now, I would say we're in line with consensus in that we see evidence of the exit environment, the monetization environment becoming more favorable for private equity this year, certainly than it's been last year in the back half of 2022. And you don't need to stretch miles to get there, because it has been a fairly muted realization environment, right? And there are a couple of drivers to that, right? One important driver is that managers have not been under tremendous pressure to sell good assets, right? At values that they think are below what they can reasonably achieve in a healthier exit environment, right?
Yeah.
There has been a bid ask on valuation. It feels like that bid ask has narrowed fairly meaningfully if you look at today versus, again, towards the end of 2022, when the market really shifted in a dramatic way.
Okay. NAV lending allows portfolio managers to extend the term in which they are invested in a particular company. So in other words, they're not under pressure to sell a company within 4 or 5 years. NAV lending allows them to extend that life cycle maybe to 5, 6, or 7 years of that investment.
It enables them to create more investment capacity.
Okay.
To pursue continued growth investment across their portfolio, right? Okay. Now, to your point, we're in an environment today where hold periods are extending, right? Versus what they were 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
Right. Again, there is a, I think, a longer term element in that. Hold periods have been extending Again, without looking at a specific point in time, but just if you think about it in a more broad-based way, hold periods are extending, right? And it's because managers and LPs alike appreciate that the best ultimate return outcome for an LP in a private equity fund is not to sell your best two assets after 2 years and print a really quick win and a good IRR.
Sure. Right?
You're better off holding on to your best assets for longer and continuing to invest behind them, right? And the proliferation of solutions for managers and investors alike, whether it's NAV finance, continuation funds, right? That ecosystem has evolved to give different stakeholders the liquidity options they need without disrupting the value creation arc, if you will.
Sure. Now, going back to kind of the liquidity scenario that we were discussing very early on about the inception of NAV lending, it makes me wonder, can a portfolio manager or even LPs kind of get together and say, listen, we need distributions now. Can you draw down on the facility to provide those distributions and returns to LPs?
It's not a dynamic that we've seen in the market, right? Okay. NAV financing, it's best used for continued growth in a portfolio, mm-hmm. right? And it is much easier to communicate the ultimate return benefit to investors when you can say, look, we have this add-on pipeline. We're very confident these add-ons are going to deliver whatever they pencil out to, right? 2.5x plus. Mm-hmm. And here's going to be the cost of capital on NAV finance. And here's why it makes sense versus the alternatives, right? It is a, with where base rates are today in particular, it is more difficult to rationalize using NAV financing purely for liquidity acceleration.
Sure. Right?
And so if investors are putting pressure on their managers to create liquidity, it's not going to come through a NAV loan, right? It's going to come from exits from the portfolio, right? Okay. That is certainly what we've seen over the past 18 months, right? It's probably becoming a more significant dynamic, right? Where there is more pressure on managers to create liquidity, but the NAV loan is not the tool to achieve that.
Okay. Any other relevant topics that we have in this current climate for NAV financing? I mean, how do you see it evolving over the next 3 to 5 years?
The number one driver of this market has been adoption.
Okay.
Right. And so that is our counterparties, right? Predominantly private equity sponsors, appreciating the value that NAV finance can have both for their funds, but also for their own business, mm-hmm. right? And then deploying those solutions across their platform. So managers utilizing NAV finance for the first time and then becoming serial users,
okay.
right? And if we think about the experience of 17 Capital, 2/3 of our investment activity is repeat business with the same counterparties.
Sure.
Right. So that's what we've seen, that once you get the organizational buy-in, once you get the support from the LPs that have backed a GP, right, they tend to become very active users of NAV finance. So we would expect the market will continue to be driven by that broad-based adoption trend. Right. Part of our job is to observe what's happening in the broader macro, understand liquidity conditions for exits, and be able to help identify the right use cases, the right rationale for utilizing our investors' capital, right, within a private equity portfolio. Okay. In those use cases, they would be different in a very stressed dislocation environment, mm-hmm. right? You could see more NAV loans being taken on to help address portfolio company level debt and refinancings, right? That's not a meaningful driver of activity today, but it certainly could be. Right. So the use cases will vary with the broader market backdrop, but the underlying trend of adoption is here to stay. Okay. Right. So our expectation is that the usage of NAV finance follows a similar path to the adoption of subscription facilities, going back to earlier in our discussion, follows a similar path to the usage of continuation vehicles and GP-led secondaries.
Okay. And I guess this brings me to my last couple of questions, and that's with regard to a distressed or a credit cycle. I don't hear much in the way of people expecting any impending doom in the financial markets right now. But let's say there is some dislocation or a credit cycle, and you have a portfolio of companies some of which do need to restructure, and they might need super senior financing like a DIP facility as they restructure. Where does NAV lending fall within that spectrum? And how do they help portfolio managers maintain some kind of value in a distressed asset, while at the same time understanding that you do need to right-size a balance sheet in a credit cycle?
Yeah. It is very much situation specific, right? And what I would say is the number one driver of whether to utilize NAV financing in a more stressed environment is the fundamental quality of the asset.
Sure.
And the true intrinsic equity value that's in that asset, okay. Right? And so a business that has underperformed and has proved to be more cyclical than the manager appreciated at the onset, mm-hmm. it's not necessarily going to be the right candidate for NAV financing, okay. Right? Because the manager is going to want to have confidence that the use of the financing will be accretive to the overall return of the portfolio, right? Mm-hmm. So because of that, NAV financing for managing portfolio company level debt is used very selectively, right? If we've helped managers repurchase debt at a discount from the underlying portfolio companies, but it was sure. very specific points in time, right? Where there was a dislocation in availability and cost of credit versus the fundamental performance of an asset, right? Okay. And there was an opportunity for that manager to create an equity return by taking advantage of that,
okay.
Right?
That's a new option out there in the toolkit for distressed managers too. Greg, listen, I really appreciate your time joining us for this edition of Primary View, and we look forward to seeing you in the capital markets. Take care.
Thank you so much, Seth.
For in-court coverage this week, we take a look at Puerto Rico, FTX Group, BlockFi, Yellow Core, SCB Financial Group, and the latest on the Medicare drug pricing negotiations. Last week, Judge Laura Taylor Swain presided over the long-awaited trial on confirmation of the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority's plan of adjustment. The plan faces opposition from certain unitholders and bondholders. Assured Guarantee, Golden Tree Asset Management, Syncora Guarantee, the PREPA Ad Hoc Group, and Bontrust to U.S. Bank poised to recover less than 3.5% of their asserted unsecured claims. Trial is slated to run through March 19th. On Thursday, the FTX Group debtors and BlockFi debtors announced a global settlement of disputes over crisscrossing claims asserted by the respective estates. The deal would resolve $1 billion of claims asserted by BlockFi in the FTX cases, $689 million principal amount of purportedly secured loan claims and about $469 million of customer claims, and various unliquidated litigation claims. The majority of BlockFi's claims would be allowed against FTX Group debtor Alameda Research. After oral argument on Wednesday, Judge Craig Goldblatt took under advisement challenges brought by 11 multi-employer pension funds and the Federal Pension Benefit Guarantee Corps to the judge's authority to allow or disallow more than $7 billion in pension claims against the Yellow Corps debtors. The multi-employer pension funds seek to send the claims to arbitration, and the Federal Pension Benefit Guarantee Corps request that the debtors' challenges to its regulations be heard by a district court judge in the District of Columbia. Allowance of the pension claims as asserted could result in equity getting nothing and other general unsecured creditors receiving pennies on the dollar from the proceeds of the debtor's liquidation, according to Yellow. At a hearing on Monday, the SB Financial Group debtor said that the March 18th disclosure statement hearing had been pushed back to April 9th while the parties continued to negotiate the designation of assets that would go to either the liquidating trust or the new code to be established under the plan. Last Friday, Judge Colm F. Connolly of the U.S. District Court for the District of Delaware denied AstraZeneca's motion for summary judgment to halt the federal government's implementation of the Medicare drug price negotiation program enacted under the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act and granted the government's cross motion for summary judgment. According to Judge Connolly, AstraZeneca lacks standing to challenge the program. He is the third district judge to reject challenges to the drug price negotiation program, which is designed to lower the prices of designated drugs that lack generic competition and account for a large portion of Medicare spending. Loparex, FGIC, Express Inc., The Children's Place, Cumulus Media, and Russell Investments round out this week's crop of near-term restructurings and refinancings and new advisor mandates. Last week, Loparex launched a debt swap after completing an exchange with holders of 75% of the first lien loans, according to sources. Some lenders already provided $135 million of new money in the form of Tranche A of a super priority term loan facility while swapping their existing first lien loans for Tranche A, B, and C loans in the facility at par or around par. Now lenders that had not been included in the first phase of the transaction need to decide if they want to exchange all or a portion of their first lien loans for Tranche C loans at 65% and second lien loans for Tranche D loans at 50%. LopareX's deal represents a spillover of non-pro rata liability management exercises now common in the U.S. high-yield and leveraged finance markets into Europe, a contagion affecting euro-denominated debt holders of a U.S. company with European and Asia operations. Financial Guarantee Insurance Co., FGIC, said last week that it had entered into a transaction support agreement with an ad hoc group of holders of FGIC-insured securities for a potential transaction to accelerate the runoff of the insured portfolio pursuant to a plan of rehabilitation dated June 4, 2023. Last week, we published an analysis comparing two mall-based clothing retailers, Express Inc. and The Children's Place, both of which are experiencing liquidity issues. Express has burned $207 million of cash, which was funded by net revolver draws, borrowings under a new term loan facility, and proceeds from a WHP joint venture transaction. Similarly, The Children's Place burned $84.7 million, funded in large part by $93 million in net revolver draws. Each company pointed to margin contractions as a reason for the cash burn, in addition to working capital requirements. An ad hoc group of creditors at Cumulus Media selected Guggenheim Securities as financial advisor. The group is represented by Gibson Dunn. A cooperation agreement is in place as the lender group with the United Front seeks to negotiate better terms of a potential transaction with the company. An ad hoc group of lenders to Russell Investments is working with Gibson Dunn as legal advisor to negotiate an amend and extend transaction for the company's term loan. Top red stories this week included: Harbinger, Apollo argue over statute of limitations and appeal of $2 billion SkyTerra LightSquared fraud suit. Vanke USD notes fall on onshore debt extension. European lenders become shareholders as DEF equity swaps pick up. New York Community Bank warns of material weakness related to internal loan review. Apex Tool 1L lenders participate in proposed transaction. Diamond Sports DIP approval paves way for commercial agreement negotiations. And now here's Kate Thomas in New York bringing you the week ahead.
Welcome to the week ahead. My name is Kate Thomas, and here are a few highlights from the upcoming week. A longer schedule of the week's events can be found under America's Week Ahead on the REARC website. The Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority confirmation trial enters its second week on Monday. The trial kicked off last week with 2 days of opening statements before moving to the evidentiary portion with witness testimony from PROMESA Oversight Board Chairman David Skeel, among others. The plan of adjustment is opposed by certain bondholders and unions and was rejected by 7 out of 14 voting classes. In particular, non-consenting bondholders, including Assured Guaranty, Golden Tree, and Syncora, say that through various settlements, the plan allows PREPA to, quote, pick winners and losers among creditors having the same rights and payment priorities, unquote. Also Monday, Three Arrows Fund Limited, or TAFL, the offshore feeder fund of Three Arrows Capital, is seeking recognition of its British Virgin Islands liquidation as a foreign main proceeding under Chapter 15. The debtor filed its petition back in February over questions related to the location and ownership of certain assets. BVI liquidators for 3AC call the timing of the TAFL petition just before a March 31st distribution to 3AC creditors, quote, deeply suspicious, unquote. The 3AC liquidators have objected to recognition, arguing that the TAFL Chapter 15 could be used to interfere with 3AC liquidation proceedings and that the 3AC founders stand to benefit almost exclusively from the TAFL Chapter 15. 3AC liquidators are seeking to recover more than $1 billion from the founders in the 3AC liquidation proceedings. On Tuesday, the Wesco and Cora trial on the company's 2022 up-tier exchange transaction is slated to resume for a 15th day. The parties are currently engaged in mediation before Judge Christopher Lopez, aimed at reaching a global resolution for both the litigation and the Chapter 11 cases. The confirmation hearing is currently scheduled to go forward on March 27th, and last week, the debtors pushed voting and confirmation objection deadlines by 1 week to March 20th at 6 p.m. Eastern. The debtor's deadline to file a plan supplement containing terms for new exit and take-back notes was also pushed to this Wednesday, March 13th. That's it for now. For more on the week ahead, check out America's Week Ahead on the REARC website, and have a great week.
Thank you again for tuning in to the REARC Primary Review and our weekly review. Find all our podcasts on the REARC.com webinars and podcast page, as well as Spotify, iTunes, SoundCloud, and Amazon. Take care and see you all next week.